Breaking Through with Kristen Ralph Finkbeiner is off this week, but please enjoy the special rebroadcast of one of our favorite episodes. Tune in next week and visit us at momsrising.org.
Welcome to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Ralph Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising on many radio networks. I'm so glad you're listening to the show this week because we have a spectacular one. It's Wonder Women to the Rescue. All of our guests are true Wonder Women, each on their own right, and they are here to inspire you, to give you ways that you can make a difference in our world, in our country, ways that you can lift all of us. So I'm really glad you're listening. Our shows include a magnificent member of Congress, U.S. Representative Suzanne Del Bene, cover what's going on with Black Breastfeeding Week. Everybody go to the hashtag BBW17. Covers what's happening with maternal mortality and how you can save women's lives and how you can get involved in the fight to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, the fight for 15. I'm so glad you're listening. We're going to jump right in with our first guest right now. We are joined by a superhero Wonder Woman for Justice, U.S. Representative Susan Del Bene. She is doing so much to stand up against Donald Trump and to stand up for liberty, justice, equity, equality, families, and the economy. I want to share with you all, we do have true superheroes in our Congress. Welcome, Representative.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're on because right now people are confused, they're scared, they're worried, they're standing up, and they're sharing their stories, they're calling their members of Congress. Does it make a difference?
I think it does make a difference, and you're absolutely right. People are standing up and sharing their stories. You know, in my office, since the beginning of this Congress and this administration, the calls and letters and emails to our office have more than doubled from what it was before. And that's because people are really engaged and want to make sure that people understand how policy would impact them, want to make sure that their legislators are listening and hearing. We've had town halls throughout my district here in Washington State, and lots of attendance and people who are very articulate about how policies will impact them and their families. And many, many women are stepping up and being vocal. And so it does make a huge difference. And I think we saw that on healthcare in particular.
Well, that leads right into my next question, which I think I know the answer to, but I want our listeners to hear directly from you. Is there hope?
I think there's hope. I think there's hope because people are engaged. And there is a responsibility on all of us to be engaged and involved and to be vocal. And so I have a lot of hope because I go throughout our region and throughout the country and hear from folks who are engaged and involved and really care about what's happening and want to make sure we move and get on a positive path. And we're going to get there because people at all levels of government and people throughout our communities are going to have loud voices.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had a funny conversation inside Moms Rising on the Moms Rising team right after for the, I don't know how many time. I mean, it's like the 50 something time we had stopped the rollback or played a role in stopping the rollback on healthcare. And we looked at each other and we said, wow, if the women and the men and the people of America can stop healthcare from being rolled back in this moment in time when that was the top priority of Donald Trump, then we can do anything. And what's your assessment of that?
Well, I think it was absolutely the voices of people throughout the country that has made a big difference in preventing really devastating healthcare legislation from moving forward. But people can't be complacent. There are going to be continued efforts to really undermine healthcare for people throughout our country. And we need to fight to protect that, but not only protect that, but to move forward and make, because there's more we can always do to make sure that everyone in our country has affordable quality health care. And so that means not only defending against bad legislation, it also means working hard to continue to move forward to make sure that we're addressing issues throughout the country and continue to improve.
See, listeners, she's awesome. She's brilliant. This is why I love her. Now, I want to ask you a question, another question. I'm working on spreading hope here. Clearly, you are amazing, and you are doing a fabulous job representing your constituents and representing the actual families and people of America. And Are there other people in Congress like you? I'm asking this question because sometimes everybody in Congress gets lumped in together with Donald Trump. And that is not the case, I can tell you. Everybody listening, that is not the case. There are true heroes in Congress. We're listening to one of them right now. But can you share a little bit about how you're not alone there in Congress?
We're definitely not alone. There are many folks who care deeply and passionately about protecting families to make sure that we have policies that are moving our country forward, who really care about our democracy and the values of our country. And that really is inspiring, I think, to me, and to be able to have folks who are working hard to do everything that we can to prevent not only bad policies from moving forward, but to defend the values of our country.
So true.
And there are people throughout every region of our country and in all levels of government, and frankly, just throughout our communities. It's not just elected officials, but there are definitely loud voices in Congress as well. And I know people appreciate being able to talk to their constituents and hear from their constituents that they support what they're doing. So that they kind of have that extra momentum when they're in Washington, D.C. to work hard and to stand up.
Absolutely. Always look for the helpers. This is what I've been thinking about a lot lately. I've been thinking about Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers. And him saying, always look for the helpers. And there are a lot of helpers in Congress. And we need to not, again, lump people together who are in Congress and lift the people who are doing a great job. So that means still calling, still sending your story, still backing up the people who are standing up for equity, equality, and justice and who are serving in Congress. Some people, we've been hearing a lot of feedback saying, you know, well, my member of Congress is on my side. I don't think I need to call them. And I'm like, yes, 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 you do need to call them. You know, we need to be the wind. Yeah, go ahead.
I agree, because I get calls now from folks to say, thank you for what you're doing. We get calls from folks who say, here's how I feel about a particular policy. And sometimes, a lot of calls that come in would tend to be more negative on issues. And now you get folks who are more positive about how a member of Congress is moving on an issue. And it's important not only because it highlights the difference of how your constituents feel. For example, in healthcare, when you get 10 calls to prevent a terrible bill from moving forward versus one that might support it, you really feel the kind of overwhelming momentum of people in your district. And so I think it is important that people call when they're concerned about something, but also call to let someone know they think they're doing the right thing. And that's definitely been a change this Congress as well. People are calling to give feedback, to give positive and negative feedback. And I think it's important that you stay engaged.
Absolutely. I hear you on the stay engaged. Democracy is not a spectator sport. It's not about one vote, one election, one Oval Office, or even one piece of legislation. And I think for it to work, we have to stay engaged because we cannot fall asleep at the wheel of democracy. We know what happens. It runs off the road. So it takes all of us being involved to make it represent us, who we are in this moment, who we are as a changing nation. Speaking of who we are in this moment and who we are as a changing nation, you've introduced recently a wonderful piece of policy, the Birth Control Privacy Act. Can you share with us a little bit about that act?
So this is a piece of legislation to address an issue that came to my attention, that some workplace wellness programs actually can share information, people's private information, with employers. And this legislation prevents women's private information from being shared with employers, because we know that, for example, if an employer knew that you might be going off of birth control because you might be planning to have a child, maybe that would impact how an employer would view that employee and what her opportunities might be going forward. So again, we think that women's personal health care information should be kept private, and wanted to address this issue by putting forward this bill called the Birth Control Privacy Act. And so continuing to build support for that to make sure that we continue to protect women's rights.
Absolutely. People, sometimes it seems, get amnesia about women's rights, or maybe that's just being kind about what's happening with women's rights. But I just want to remind people that women have the ability to choose when and how many children that they are going to have has been nothing short of revolutionary for women's freedom, for our economic prosperity, and for our country and world. You know, right now we have an average of about 2 children per person, and 99% of women in the United States of America have used birth control at some point in their life. So we can't sort of take that for granted or get amnesia about the fights that have led us to be able to control our own reproductive health. And we have to support bills like the Birth Control Privacy Act. We cannot let birth control be limited. And do you see this sort of rising tide of either amnesia or actual attack on women's ability to control their reproductive rights happening in Congress right now? Can you share a little bit about what's going on?
Well, we've definitely seen many attacks. You know, instead of talking about important issues like equal pay for equal work, we're having to defend our most basic constitutional rights to make our own healthcare decisions. We've seen attacks on allowing healthcare plans to cover birth control. We've even heard from our Secretary of Health and Human Services that he isn't convinced that insurance coverage for birth control is important, that it's not really critical to women having access to birth control. And we know that that's absolutely not true, and that birth control is essential health care. It's essential health care, plain and simple. It not only helps women plan for their families, but it's also used by thousands of women to treat medical conditions like endometriosis or ovarian cysts. So when we talk about denying women medically necessary health care, especially when it's based on ideology, it's unjustifiable, it's wrong, and we see it happening every day. We had a select committee last Congress just to really to try to come up with reasons to deny a woman's right to choose. And so this is something where we have to consistently be persistent to be strong, because many gains have been made, but those could be lost very quickly if we don't continue to fight and make sure people understand how important these issues are.
And even as you're talking, I'm checking the calendar. Yes, it's 2017, people, and we are talking about this. It is 2017. And sometimes it reminds me, just, we stand on the shoulders of giants of women in the women's rights movement for generations. You know, we're generations into this fight, and we are absolutely not turning back right now, but we have to keep the pressure on. And it's ridiculous that it's 2017 and we have to keep the pressure on, but indeed that is the case. One other thing I think sometimes isn't brought up often enough in this conversation around women's reproductive health and justice and access to it is that this is important for our economy. 50% of our entire labor force are women right now. And when women don't have access to the health care that they need, it just really hurts our whole economy, not just women's individual health. So it's key. Go ahead.
It also impacts families. Right?
Absolutely.
It's not just women. It's women and families. And so it has an economic impact across our country, because women are working and supporting families along with men. And if a woman's economic opportunity is limited, that limits the opportunity for the entire family.
Absolutely. It now costs $200,000 to raise a child from birth to age 18, not including college. So being able to do that family planning is essential, so that you can support and lift the children that are in our households. It just makes me so mad. Do you know this story that my great-grandma was the first president of the Rochester, New York chapter of Planned Parenthood in the time of Susan B. Anthony? And my grandma, who's 102 and still telling history, remembers moments when there were just people banging on her front door protesting at my great-grandmother's house because my great-grandmother had the audacity to talk about the need for birth control. And so my very mitochondria is annoyed that we are still fighting this fight. I'm like, wait a minute. Hold up here.
So
my great-grandma and grandma were involved in this, huh?
When you talk about having to continue to stand up and be persistent, your great-grandmother would be proud to know that you're carrying on that legacy still today.
Yeah, she'd be annoyed, though. I knew her. She would be, what would you call it? We need something else and persist. And then I've sort of silently lately been at it, impeached. We're not going to talk about that today. But resist and persist. But I think there's some part in there like, you know, annoyed, perturbed, you know, what the heck?
We have made progress. We did, you know, in the last 5 years, we've had 55 million women who've had access to birth control at no cost. Because of progress that we made and under President Obama, and we cannot roll back the progress we made. And so it is important to persist and help us continue to protect what we have and move forward.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on with us today. Thank you for inspiring us. Thank you for sharing your hope. And thank you for all you do for your country, our country, my country, each and every day.
Hey, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around. We'll be right back with our next guest who's going to talk about hashtag BBW17. Yep, you want to know what that is. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rau Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising on the We Act Radio Network, TuneIn's Progressive Voices Network, the Union Edge Radio Network, and many other stations across the nation. Right now, we are joined by Anaya Shango Dele Ayoka, and she is amazing, people. You are going to love hearing from her. She has been a nurse midwife, an organizer, an innovative cultural worker leveraging digital media to impact health and parenting. She is the co-founder of Black Breastfeeding Week, the co-editor of Free to Breastfeed, the voices of Black mothers. She has won so many awards, I can't even count them. Her work has been written about by Salon, The Huffington Post, Ms. Magazine, My Brown Baby, and Think Progress. She's a graduate of Yale University and Vassar College. She's also the mom of two boys. Welcome, Anaya.
Thank you so much, Kristen.
I have always just really admired your ability to do so many things at the same time. So can you share with our listeners an update of what's on your plate right now so they too can be in awe of you?
Okay, great. So today is August 25th, the first day of Black Breastfeeding Week. Black Breastfeeding Week occurs annually, August 25th through August 31st. So we are right in the swing of things. So that's the hugest portion on my plate at the moment. I'm also a practicing nurse midwife in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I attend to the healthcare of women and girls and babies down here in North Carolina.
Which is, all of those things are spectacular. Now, let's talk about breastfeeding month and breastfeeding week. August is breastfeeding month. And as you just said, the last week in August is Black Breastfeeding Week. What are the hurdles that breastfeeding moms face?
So the hurdles are many. I think across the board, there tends to be a dearth of actual support, tangible support for lactation and breastfeeding in our communities. And so that runs the gamut from being exposed to the vast benefits of breastfeeding prenatally, and then like once a person actually has their child, to have support for continuing, starting, maintaining, feeling positive, troubleshooting concerns with breastfeeding and lactation after babies are born. So that's like a whole world unto itself. Where are the resources for help? Having healthcare providers and support people who understand your circumstances, who understand your cultural background, who are accessible and who can be compensated, because in a lot of times, that's also the hurdle, is that insurance may not cover coverage, there may not be enough providers in your area, and then people have to pay out of pocket. Another huge hurdle is one that I'm sure gets discussed all the time on the show, is lack of leave, paid family leave specifically. We all know that in order for breastfeeding to succeed and to go well, people need to have time to get it established. It really is a relationship being built within the family, between that person who's lactating and the baby, getting used to it. And when so many women and people go back to work after having a baby after 10 days, it really, really does just pull the rug from under you to get breastfeeding established. And we know that those are factors across the board. They are amplified even more in communities of color, especially in Black families. We know that we have lower initiation rates, lower continuation rates, across the board. It's tied to historical concerns. It's tied to actual present-day discrimination in lactation, in the lactation world. It's tied to a ton of things, including all those financial concerns. So I just said a mouthful, but it really is a complex world.
I was just admiring all that you were saying. I was like, wow, you are on. That is so important for everybody to know. And a lot of people, I was just thinking as you were talking, a lot of people don't realize how important it is to give women the ability to choose to breastfeed, and that so many women don't have the ability to make that choice. And so I just want to give a little perspective to folks who are listening. 82% of women do have children by the time they are 44 years old. We're not talking about five women here. We're talking about the majority of women in America facing the hurdles that Anaya was just sharing with you. And often these hurdles are faced individually, sort of in a solitary manner. It's often one of the busiest times and sometimes even one of the most isolating times of your life right after you have a baby, because you're learning how to be a mom, how to nurse, how to juggle the rest of your life with having a new presence in your life, you know, a new person in your life. And it's at that moment that all these hurdles rise up. And so I feel like often these particular hurdles don't get talked enough in the public eye and are framed as an individual concern rather than a societal concern. And what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely the case. We really, we put individual families and mothers and lactating people in the position of having to go up against so much, against the whole system that is not set up to support. And that's what we're trying to create. We're trying to create those changes in the system that will support them. And then also going up against the huge market and marketing that says that formula is just as good as breast milk, that says that makes formula super accessible, and the, you know, just a huge marketing machine. So on the one hand, you don't have the carrot and you only have the stick, so to speak.
Yep.
And I think there's a sort of another side of it is also that in communities of color, we also find that you have the, like I said, historical background. You have some sort of, you like to have sort of over-sexualization issues. And we have generations of people who have not breastfed. So for something that used to be like very much your aunties and cousins or moms, like other people in your family could teach you, could help you troubleshoot, you know, the way we live today, that whole structure is sort of destabilized. And when you have generations of people before you who have not breastfed and may even have trauma from it because of their own experiences or what was passed down to them, it really does create a huge taboo and actually like a sort of social liability to breastfeeding.
How can people get involved in breaking down those barriers and, in particular, supporting Black Breastfeeding Week?
Oh, that's such a good question. So I think that for people who feel like on the fence about it and like, what, breastfeeding is not that important, or, you know, really it's just getting babies fed is the most important, I think some just becoming more aware of what the reality is, because many people are not making that choice, just like you said. And there are a ton of healthcare concerns that I do want to point out, that especially in community of color, particularly Black women, there are things like Black women tend to get the most aggressive forms of breast cancer and die at high rates. And we know that one of the only things a person can do with the most aggressive forms of breast cancer is breastfeed. That's the number one thing that you can do to reduce your risk, is to breastfeed after you've had children. So there's a whole host of reasons why we know that breastfeeding is more important or super important, and we need to promote it and make it more accessible. So I think that paying attention beyond skepticism and actually sort of like listening to people's stories, paying attention to the research is really, really important. So I encourage people to have some humility there. And also to just join us, blackbreastfeedingweek.org. We are Black Breastfeeding Week on all the social media channels. Join our celebration. Black Breastfeeding Week really is a celebration. We don't talk a ton about the disparities. We know they're there. Our goal is really to push against them, to highlight the people and organizations and families that are doing the work in their communities and lifting it up in joy and having a good time with it. So I always invite people to be a part of the celebration with us. Join Moms Rising, of course, pushing forward with paid family leave is super important. So we're always very excited to do that work with Moms Rising. And there's a ton of other organizations. If you just like tune into any of our social media channels, we're always promoting the work that other people are doing.
And is the hashtag, what's the hashtag? I love hashtags.
Oh, yes, the hashtag this year is BBW17 for the year. Our theme is Bet on Black. So Bet on Black is a hashtag. Also, Black Breastfeeding Week is an evergreen one that's always there. You can always find us at that hashtag.
I love it. I love it. I just am hashtag obsessed lately. And I see.
That's so useful.
Yes, I know. I'm like, can I just use the hashtag to search through this giant Twitterverse? Because it is huge, huge. So much going on. So BBW17 is the main hashtag.
Yeah, BBW17 is the main one.
Okay, everybody, mark that. Write that down. Be there. BBW17. I love what you said about people not knowing how important breastfeeding is and how different it is than formula. And I do want to acknowledge that some people cannot breastfeed, and that is
Absolutely.
Something to be respected as well. I also want to share my own story. My son was born without IgA. He had very little IgA. There are only mm-hmm. 5 classes of antibodies in our bodies, and he was missing one of them. And it turned out that the only way, there's no pill, there's no shot, there's no medicine to get IgA back in you. The only way to get IgA is actually through breast milk. And I had no idea. And so basically breastfeeding saved his life. You know, I mean,
wow.
It's just really an incredible learning for me. I didn't quite realize, you know, because you do see all the advertisements about formula, it's just as good as breast milk and all that kind of stuff. But when there are often serious health considerations at stake, and it can actually be life-saving in the immediate sense, not just,
yeah.
you know, like helping you in the long term with your health, which is also very, very, very important. But in the immediate sense, you know, that is the only way to get IgA into a baby. So
yeah,
it's a big deal.
Wow, Kristen, thank you for sharing that. I did want to also say that there are human milk banks where people donate breast milk,
which is
and make it available. So that's something that is a part of this sort of growing lactation world that people are really trying to push even more to make human milk accessible to babies especially when people can't breastfeed, don't have access to it. Of course, we know formula saves lives. And we want that to be accessible to people, but we do want it to be accessible responsibly, because we know that breast milk is the biological norm. It's generally better. But of course, we want babies to be fed.
Yeah. I mean, and I think one of the controversies about formula is that oftentimes women will go into a hospital facility, have a baby, and then a doctor or a nurse or a medical professional will give them a free package that includes formula. So it's almost like receiving a prescription, big time subliminal messaging that, hey, maybe you should formula feed and not nurse. You know, and so really getting it out there that breastfeeding does have major advantages over formula for babies is important. And can you talk a little bit about that dynamic of what we're up against in terms of the medical field often?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. You know, none of us, I feel like it's really difficult to even get close to overestimating the power of media and the power of marketing and promotion in our lives. And when people receive free samples, actual free products of formula, and a lot of hospitals, women actually leave with duffel bags full of formula. Our studies show that it's a guaranteed pipeline to people being committed to that particular to formula and to that particular brand. So formula companies know from the outset that if they can just get to families right at the beginning, that they have a guaranteed loyal base, and that it also undermines breastfeeding. So a lot of people will think, oh, I'll just give some formula and some breast milk, but it really does make it difficult. Can make it difficult for babies to get adjusted to doing both, if they're doing bottle and breast or milk and formula at the same time from the beginning. So it really, you know, they're not the same, although formula can definitely save lives. This is why the education piece is so important. I always say in our breastfeeding promotion, there are people who would like think that breastfeeding promotion is out of control and like people are way too staunch about it. But I'd like to say, like, if you really think about the fact that there is no lobby, there is no marketing, so to speak, for human milk. And that is really done by the cheerleaders, the people on the ground, healthcare professionals who are saying, we really know that this is better, the scientists and the researchers. We don't have billions of dollars to promote lactation and breastfeeding. If we did, you know, lots of things would be different. We'd have so much lactation support. We'd have the carrots and not just the sticks. So I think what you said is really important. The promotion of formula is really critical. Even as families get as a part of WIC, we want families to have access. People definitely need to be able to feed their babies. And that's what we know from studies of WIC families. That's one of the number one ways that formula companies get their market share, especially if, for example, their formula is given out to WIC families. Whoever the company is that has that contract at that particular time is the number one formula company in the country. And because it just breeds loyalty. And it really sets them up for only being able to give formula.
And another thing that's often not talked about is that while there may be free samples at a hospital or a medical facility right after the baby arrives, it's actually way more expensive in the long run to use formula than to breastfeed. And people don't,
people don't say that. And especially, thank goodness, you know, we still have the Affordable Care Act. Even now with the Affordable Care Act, it did expand coverage for lactation support. It expanded coverage for breast pumps. So almost everyone who has any type of insurance gets a breast pump covered by their insurance, by Medicaid, delivered to their doorstep if they need that to help support breastfeeding. And you know, like we said, most people don't have access to paid family leave and they're going back to work sooner. So it can help to extend their breastfeeding relationship there. So I think that in and of itself, because a lot of times that the one-time cost of a breast pump being $200 or $300, even though formulas more expensive in the long run, that one investment in a pump to continue breastfeeding can be insurmountable to families. And I think that the free breast pumps or the breast pumps covered by insurance have gone a long way to ensuring that people can pump and can continue breastfeeding. And then you just have, you know, you have the other side of it. Of course, there is the cost of, once again, being able to support your family, being able to stay home. I definitely don't want to minimize that because I've been on both sides of not having any leave covered whatsoever and like trying to patch it together with sick days and thinking, okay, well, I really want to spend another month or 6 weeks with my baby. So I'm just going to have to figure out, you know, cash out some of my retirement or borrow money from someplace. So we know that that's a huge concern for people and they don't want to, you know, they want to breastfeed and they know it's important, but they also are like, I need to keep my job and I need to keep money coming in. So, you know, I think that can't be underscored enough.
So people, if you can do it, it's an option that you should seriously consider. And everybody should go to #BBW17, get involved in Black Breastfeeding Week 2017 right now. Thank you so much, Anaya, for all you do. Thanks for being on the show. Thanks for helping to spread the word. Thank you for making our nation healthier.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around. Next, we have some startling news about women dying in childbirth in the United States of America. Find out how you can help save lives. We'll be back in a quick flash. Welcome back to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rau Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising on the We Act Radio Network, TuneIn's Progressive Voices Network, the Union Edge Radio Network, and many other stations across the nation. We are joined right now by... This is going to be called the Wonder Woman Show, people. Just so you know, this is the Wonder Woman Show. Another Wonder Woman, Monifa Bendele, who is the Moms Rising Vice President. She is leading the nation toward equity, equality, and justice. Thank you so much for being on with us, Monifa.
Thanks for having me.
I am so excited that you're here, and I'm so excited that I get to work with you because we need to talk about some things with the nation. And one of those things we need to talk about is maternal mortality. So while all of the chaos is happening and Donald Trump is doing nutty tweets, there's actual serious issues going on in our country that are being ignored. Maternal mortality is really up there on the list. Can you share with our listeners what everyone should know?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, mothers dying during pregnancy and childbirth is a crisis that most Americans believe impacts mothers in countries experiencing like extreme poverty, shortages of food and healthcare providers, medicine, water and housing. You know, people think of war-torn nations where there's like inadequate infrastructure and inadequate hospitals. So when we talk about this issue of like it being dangerous to give birth for women in the United States, people are a little shocked. But the truth of the matter is that the United States is increasing its rate of maternal mortality while the rest of the world, even the developing world, but definitely developed world, has managed to decrease those rates of mothers dying during pregnancy and childbirth. So it's a silent crisis.
It's a silent crisis that, according to the World Health Organization, listeners, has almost doubled in the past 20 years. So just like Monifa said, now we're the industrialized nation with the highest maternal mortality rate in the world.
And it's, you know, and it shouldn't be like that. And then when you really drill down to communities of color, Black women are experiencing death during pregnancy and childbirth 3 to 4 times the rate of white women. So there's also a huge equity issue because of many of our apartheid-like health experiences that happen in hospitals, definitely during labor and delivery, but everything that happens throughout the whole, you know, from the time you're pregnant to postpartum is like a huge disparity. And so the treatment of Black mothers is part of what's driving that high rate in the United States.
And it's awful. It's awful. What can people do? Like, immediately when I hear about these things, it just makes me so mad. What can people do to help this, to help save lives?
So first thing we have to do with all of our campaigns, you know, at Moms Rising, you have to, like, convince people there's a crisis, right? And so what we're working on right now is really shedding light on this, like, silent killer that's happening all over the country. We're drilling down in places like Texas, which, if it were its own country, has the highest maternal mortality rate of a developed nation, and let people know that this is going on. So, you know, to join Moms Rising, join the conversation. We're having town halls. We're having film festivals in L.A. We're doing tweet chats to really spread the word about what are some of the hospital protocols that aren't being carried out that are causing this, and what is the healthcare access that many mothers aren't able to get that's also driving this deadly phenomena. So definitely join on to Moms Rising. And what we're doing right now, like this very moment, if you go to our website, is that we're collecting stories. We want people to share their labor and delivery stories, you know, whether they were wonderful and what went well with them or whether they almost lost their own lives. Did they have preeclampsia, high blood pressure during pregnancy? You know, what kinds of things did they experience? And what was the healthcare provision like for them throughout the process? Because we want to use that to take it to people in power and really change a lot of the policies and practices and procedures in hospitals. But at the top of that, Kristen, we've got to protect healthcare.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's under threat like every other day. Can I share with you?
Every day. It's under threat. And people think it's over, but it is not.
No. It's not over. I think Moms Rising has stood up to defend healthcare, the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid, et cetera, more than 75 times. I was trying to count earlier today. There have been more than 75 times that the Republican extremists have tried to roll it back.
It's crazy. Nothing protects it as much as people sharing their real life stories. Like, I would be dead right now if I didn't have A, B, C, or D. And I think that it's important that we continue to shout that out. Also, a lot of people don't know that half of all childbirths in the country are covered by Medicaid. So we can't forget about Medicaid either. Like, Medicaid is really like the big fish, so to speak. You know, it is the most important provider of health care to people as they are born into this world, right?
And
so we have to make sure that that is not pulled away in the United States. It would be devastated and it would drive this maternal mortality rate through the roof, actually.
Yes. And actually, we have an example. In Texas, the state of Texas, there has been a significant rollback on programs like Medicaid, and they actually have, I don't know, I'd have to relook at it, but one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. What? Do you remember the data on Texas?
So Texas has the highest maternal mortality rate in the country. And if it were its own country, like if you just isolate Texas's rate, it is the leader in the developed world of women dying during childbirth. And so they have done things like rolled back on, you know, not expanding access to healthcare programs like Medicaid, but also closing reproductive health clinics all over the state so that there's only very few that women with little resources can access. And so right away, you see an uptick in deaths in the last couple of years. I also want to add it, it's not just deaths. You know, some people nearly die, you know, and we have what we call maternal morbidity, or they develop a condition during childbirth and delivery or postpartum that causes their life to shorten on the other end. So, you know, we're looking strictly at the deaths, but the impact of having access to poor health care or not having access to health care or experiencing racial bias in the health care delivery system is killing people. And in fact, we just led a campaign in Texas was an amazing group called the Texas Jail Project. One of the places where pregnant women have the worst access to health care are in jails and prisons.
Yes.
And so what people don't understand about jails in the country, you know, they think they're like prisons, but most of the people in jails haven't been convicted of anything. Jail is a place for pretrial detainees, for the most part, who can't afford to bail themselves out. You know, it's like it's a place for people who don't have resources as they await trial. So it's really like unfair. If you've got money, a lot of times you're not going to end up in jail until you actually have a trial and you're convicted of something. So there's a lot of women and mothers in these jails, and they become very dangerous places for pregnant women. There was a case that we worked on a couple of years ago with Nicole Guillermo, who was in solitary confinement, went into labor, and her baby died while she was in jail. Again, just waiting, a pretrial detainee. And just this past 2 weeks, we've been working with a woman in Beaumont, Texas, named Candace Washington, whose family reached out to us because she, too, was awaiting trial, but she was 7.5 months pregnant, and she was a high-risk pregnancy. Her doctor was like, she can't be in jail, you know? And so you have these situations that really drive this rate. So there needs to be reforms both in the larger healthcare systems, making sure we have access to healthcare, but just also making sure that everywhere women are, they can also access healthcare. And to be quite honest, jail is no place for pregnant women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, we're seeing some forward momentum on people addressing this. And how can people get involved?
Sure. So one of our big actions right now is to join on and to stand with the family of Candace Washington. We did have a huge victory yesterday that we'll share more soon to all of our members, where we believe that she is going to be able to get out and stay out. But please share your story, join Moms Rising, indicate that you want to work on this issue, because we're going to need people in every state to come and speak out at their state house, talk to decision makers, and help us to promote policies and procedures for hospitals that will ensure that mothers are safe and able to care for their babies. And then all of our issues really, Kristen, connect to this issue. When we fight for paid family leave, and we just had this huge victory in Washington, yay, that helps too. You know, too often women are given birth, even having C-sections, and having to return to work so that they can, you know, save their livelihoods and feed their families. And that puts them in danger when they really should be on bed rest. They should, like, not be working and not be walking. And so we see a lot of serious injuries and deaths, even postpartum, and paid family leave would definitely help to stem that.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that people don't realize is that people don't realize this is happening. This is truly a silent killer. And it's so much of a silent killer that not every state tracks maternal mortality and morbidity in the same way. So it's actually very hard to get national data about what's happening. And it can even be hard to find patterns of exactly how women are dying in childbirth and thereafter, because the data isn't tracked the same way. So one policy that's moving forward is a law through Congress that is just simply to track the data evenly across the states. You know, It doesn't take a giant movement or revolution to say, hey, let's track the data accurately. You know, I mean, this is not like shouldn't be controversial. And it is very true that the way that women are receiving care is very different in different areas. So, for example, I myself, when I was having my daughter, experienced hemorrhaging, which was fixed very quickly. But that is one of the top reasons women die in childbirth here in the United States and around the world. And it is not actually that uncommon to happen. Please don't be afraid to have babies. I'm worried we're scaring people all of a sudden. But, you know, that happened to me. I know several other women that happened to. And I lived because there were standard procedures for that type of emergency, which has to be dealt with immediately in the hospital where I gave birth. But many women are not, because there are not standard procedures for what to do when that happens across the board in all hospitals in the United States of America. So this is what we're talking about making sure that all patients are treated equitably, equally, and with full care, and that all hospitals are actually using the best procedures possible. And can you share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And like you mentioned, just this year in March, there was introduced the Preventing Maternal Deaths Act of 2017, really helping states to identify what are the root causes. We work closely with a family in California, since you mentioned hemorrhaging as a cause of death. A woman named Kiara Dixon Johnson died during birth, during delivery in April of last year. And one of the things that happened to her was that her hemorrhaging was not attended to properly. And so her family and Moms Rising has been working to push California to not just have the hospitals agree to a protocol, but to really have those protocols legislated, right? Because we know that so much can happen when you say, well, here's a recommendation of what you should do, or here's what you need to do by law. Unfortunately, as late as last year, there were studies done by Harvard showing that medical professionals all over the country, even medical students, had some really like false mythology and assumptions around Black people and Black women as it related to our blood's ability to coagulate and clot. They had concepts that Black people could tolerate greater amounts of pain than white people and therefore gave out less pain medication to Black patients. And so this study really revealed that kind of like leaving things up to the ideas and the training and experiences of individual healthcare providers, while many of them are great, puts patients at a great risk because there's a tremendous amount of bias in the system through independent actors. So putting these policies in place in hospitals is one step, but making sure that all of our states and across the board, there's really clear guidelines. Like, this is what you do if someone is bleeding. You don't have to look at her and say, like, ah, I think she's not at risk. You know what I'm saying? But you must act on it.
And act right immediately.
Like a meningitis protocol. I had my kid, like, she had a sore throat and couldn't bend her neck. And they were like, oh, right away. ER, here's the test. We start they even start treating you before the tests come back because there's a protocol by law in the city around meningitis. And so we want to protect our mothers. And that's really what we're fighting for right now.
Thank you so much, Monifa, for being on the show today. And thanks for all you do. Thank you for being a Wonder Woman.
Oh, thank you. And thanks to everybody for listening. I appreciate it.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go away. This segment coming up talks about how raising the minimum wage can raise the economy and how you can make a difference. We'll talk to you in a brief moment. Welcome back to Breaking Through with me, Kristen Rau Finkbeiner, powered by Moms Rising on the WEACT Radio Network, TuneIn's Progressive Voices Network, and on the Union Edge and other stations. Right now, we are joined by another Wonder Woman. This is the Wonder Woman show, people. We all are wearing capes today. I hope every listener is wearing a cape, too. The Wonder Woman who's joining us right now is Bridget Hughes. She is working, fighting for justice. She's fighting for $15 an hour for minimum wage. She's in the union rights fight for many years. And welcome, Bridget.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're on. How did you get involved in the fight for the $15 minimum wage?
It originally started with some coworkers of mine talking about the $15 wage increase that was going on in the city, which I had seen some local news reports about, and I decided to go to a meeting with some of my coworkers, and I related to other workers who were facing similar struggles, and I decided it was time for me to stand up and make a change.
Absolutely. Was it sort of, what was that moment like for you? You're sort of sitting in a meeting. Can you bring us into the room where that meeting was happening? And you're like, whoa, this is it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to dive in.
Originally when I walked in, I was expecting maybe 10, 15, 20 people. And I walked into a room full of hundreds of workers. I mean, it was so packed that I literally was standing up against the wall. And one of our leaders in the movement, Terrence, had got up and was speaking about the strike that was coming up on that particular year. And I heard some other workers about things they were facing because of their low wages, and they were others too. And I was like, it doesn't make sense for anybody in America to be living in poverty, and I need to fight up and stand up and fight back and take what we deserve.
Absolutely. I mean, right now, We have people working full-time, year-round, working hard, playing by the rules, and still living in poverty in the United States of America because the minimum wage is too low to be a living wage. And we know that raising the minimum wage helps the economy, helps families, helps businesses, and actually many studies show actually increases employment levels. And yet we still have extraordinarily low wages. And that, let's go to hurting the economy. When you don't have money to spend in local stores on buying your children clothing, shoes, etc., then actually the whole economy suffers. And too many people don't talk about that part. What do you think, as you've been talking about the need for raising the wage to $15 an hour, has been the most compelling argument to people as you've been out there talking to people?
The fact that I personally have faced situations where I couldn't even afford to buy my son a $10 pair of shoes. At one point, he went to school with shoes that were so beaten up because I was trying to scrape the money together to get the shoes that his principal actually had to step in and buy him some shoes because they were too bad. He had wood chips in his shoes during recess and was crying. And I mean, the sad fact is that there's hundreds of thousands of Missourians and workers across the world who can't even afford a basic pair of shoes. And the reality is, if we could afford those things, we would be putting more money into those small businesses that can't seem to grow because nobody has the income to even shop in their business, let alone help these families be able to afford those basic needs that we need and be able to pay our utilities bills. We won't have to depend on government assistance as much, which will save taxpayer dollars. It's going to generally increase the economy all the way around.
Absolutely. And really, what we're talking about is a giant subsidy to corporations when the wages are so low. So, for example, Walmart, the largest private employer in our nation, when people apply, are often provided with a form to fill out to get SNAP, which is great. I totally support SNAP. SNAP is also known as food stamps. But what's happening is Walmart knows they're not paying a livable wage, people. That's the underlying exactly. message. So instead of paying a livable wage, they're saying, hey, taxpayers, you pay for the make up the difference in a living wage by, supporting programs like SNAP, which, again, are critically important. As an aside, SNAP, for every $1 in that goes into this program, $1.79 at least comes out because of the stimulus to our economy that it provides, because then people are able to actually buy food and put that money into the economy, and it goes right back into the economy to help stimulate the economy. So SNAP is a good thing. I'm not saying anything bad about SNAP, food stamps, but I am saying that paying a living wage is essential, and many large corporations are actually getting a free ride on the coattails of taxpayers instead of paying a living wage themselves. And they know they're not paying a living wage because they're handing up the forms at the hiring moment. Have you seen exactly. forward progress? What have you seen? What hope do you have out there?
We have had a lot of progress with this movement. We've won raises for 22 million workers across the country.
Whoa!
Yeah, 22 million workers have won raises. We've won things locally as far as we did an action against having safety equipment in a lot of our stores. And now we have our employers looking at those things, you know, first aid kits and gloves and protective masks and things that we didn't used to have. A lot of them do now. Not all of them, so we got to keep working on it, but a lot of them do. We've protected workers against sexual harassment. We've protected workers against unfair treatment on the job, racism, discrimination. So the movement is working, and not just in the corporations, but it's working at a government level as well. I mean, we've had actions like the Andy Pudser case, for instance. We got Andy Pudser to withdraw his nomination as Labor Secretary, and I truly believe that that was the work of the workers.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, let's talk about unions for a minute. Sometimes people are like, hey, I don't understand what unions do. Can you share with people what unions do? Because I love unions, by the way.
A union is a group of workers coming together to use our strength in numbers to get things done together that we can't normally get on our own. With a union, we also have the power to win raises from our employers that outside politicians would not be able to take away from us.
Absolutely. And the union has brought us the weekend, the 40-hour work week, child labor laws.
Equal pay for one, you know, versus the men and women pay gap that has been reduced upon a union, you know, protection against sexual harassment, protection against discrimination, protection of our wages, protections on the job itself, you know, as far as the risk of the job, security on the job, a voice on the job. Like, a union is so much more than just money.
So true. How can people get involved? Do you have advice for people who are listening right now and like, wait, I need to be part of any union? How do I get involved in a union?
As far as joining Stand Up KC, you can go to our Facebook page. And also on September 4th, we are going to have a strike with workers across the city, as well as allies, community allies who are coming to support us, to reclaim the meaning of Labor Day back. Labor Day started as a national strike of workers who were fighting for better pay, respect on their jobs, and a union. And we're going to remind everybody of that meaning of Labor Day, and we're going to strike out and call for higher wages and a union on our jobs to be able to protect us for our jobs. So, I mean, you can come out and join us for that on September 4th. Across the country, not just in Missouri, to let these politicians know that they need to get out of the way and allow our raises to go through, and also to let these corporations know that they have a choice to make. They can either keep being greedy and taking all of the profits that they're getting and keeping their workers in poverty, or they can do the right thing, the moral thing, and they can give us a livable wage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, giving a livable wage is helping them, because if nobody can afford to shop in any of the stores or to be part of the economy, then all the businesses falter too. So it's not just like, hi, can we have a present? It's like, hello, can we make the pay that we deserve so that we all can prosper? I mean, it drives me nuts the way this is framed sometimes. Does it you?
Exactly. And in our case, when the vote went to the ballot for the 15, 70% of Kansas City voted in support of the raise of minimum wage. So clearly, this is what people feel like we need. They feel like we need a livable wage. We need to have $15 an hour and a union. So our politicians need to respect what the workers and what the community is calling for.
Thank you. Well, thank you for all that you're doing. Thank you for being on the show today. Thank you for taking the time to talk and share with our listeners what's going on.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's it for our show today. Thanks so much for tuning in as we lift the voices of true Wonder Women across the nation. I've been thinking a lot about Mr. Rogers. Yes, I have. And about how he says to always look for the helpers, always look for those who are making a positive difference. And that has been very important to me personally in these trying times when we have Donald Trump doing ridiculous, horrifying, awful things that are hurting our democracy, our country, and our economy. And so I'm so glad to have been able to share on this show some of the people who are giving me hope. I hope they give you hope, too. And I'm thankful that you're listening to a show that is so up on current events that it requires a disclaimer. So here you go. Views expressed on this show are those of the individual speakers and should not be attributed to Moms Rising, to this station, or to any news or social media service that may disseminate a recording of this show to the public or to any segment of the public. I hope you tune in again next week as we bring forward more superheroes for justice, for equity, and for equality in a show that also will require a disclaimer. We'll talk with you again soon.